accession number 6024, reel 6.
Mr. Humphrey, reel 6. Apart from these approved official contacts you had with the women's camp, were there any unofficial contacts or communications at all?
Well, contacts, I think I could say nil. To my knowledge, I don't know of any man having dared to go within the perimeter of the women's camp unless it was authorised, or vice versa, any women coming into our camp. And I'm quite sure that if it had happened, the repercussions on both camps would have been extremely severe. As regards communications, yes, of course there were attempts by husbands to pass messages to their wives through various channels, and occasionally, of course, wrongly, to wave to their wives or to try to whisper to them, particularly at night, across the wire. But any of that sort of thing, if it was caught, meant an immediate physical assault by a Japanese guard. And possibly if it was something more serious would have happened. So there was very little, really.
Could the guards be bribed into aiding this sort of communication?
Well, we really had next to nothing to bribe them with. Blackmailed, possibly, if they'd done something one knew was wrong, and which they knew was wrong in the eyes of their own superiors, but we really had no means of bribing guards.
Can you give me an example of where and under what circumstances blackmail was used?
Well, I think earlier in this talk I mentioned one instance where a guard had started beating up an officer.
And he lost his rifle. Are there any other examples?
Offhand, I can't think of one, but that we always watched very carefully, and I'm sure that the Grove clerk on a number of occasions got a guard to, you know, to stop doing what he was doing under the veiled hint that he would otherwise report it to his Japanese officers.
Now, as far as the military camps were concerned, whether officers or other ranks, did your camp have contact with them at all?
Officially, no. Across the wire, sometimes, yes. They had a harder time than we had, really, because they were forced to produce a much greater percentage of their numbers in outside working parties and in conditions where their health was beginning to run very badly. This, in fact, killed a lot of them off. We were not compelled to produce, in proportion to our numbers, such large working parties. Although we were often producing between 100 and 150 to go out, which was a lot out of 200 plus, 240, 50.
What sort of things would excite your contact? What would stimulate it? What cause for it was there for making this contact?
Well, generally asking if there were any rumours, if anyone had heard anything, any news, whether they or any members of their camp perhaps had made a contact in the town when they were out on their working parties and perhaps got a titbit of information from a Chinese or anything of that sort, because the one thing we were almost as hungry for as for food was news. I mean, we could not see the end of the tunnel. That was the real headache of the whole 3.5 years. And so there was always attempts to find out from any source whether there was any information. What were the Japs doing? Did they look panicky and all this sort of thing? And did they look? Well, did they overhear anybody talking, which had indicated whereabouts the war was going on? How close to us had it got?
Can you recollect any occasions when specifically valuable information was gleaned by this means?
No, no. But hope springs eternal, you see, and no, I don't remember any useful information coming through that source. But occasionally also the soldiers took risks with their working parties and got goods or articles of one sort and another from people whom they contacted while they were outside, working outside their camp. And I believe that one or two of them, in fact I know that one or two of them, then traded those articles that they'd got for things that our people, or one or more of our people, might have, which they wanted, or which that particular individual wanted. In other words, there was a certain amount of illicit bartering of goods going on.
What kind of stuff went over the fence?
Well, on our side, particularly I think from the Dutch, money went across to a soldier who then might be able to produce a bit of tobacco from somewhere, or a bit of soap, or a bit of paper to write on, or any simple things like that.
And what did they seem to be after?
The soldiers?
Yes.
Well, more money, I suppose, really, you see, because insofar as people had money and could spend it, even able to use it to buy things through a contact in the town, which they were in a better position to get than we were, owing to the fact they had more people working outside the camp, it meant a source of a driblet source of supplies of things that were needed.
Were you able to draw any conclusions from your observations about the relative standards of treatment the Japanese gave to the officers on the one hand and the other ranks on the other?
No, I didn't think there was much difference in it. My recollection is that, at any rate, in the part of the camp where my hut was located, I didn't see any British officers. They were too far away. We did have a common perimeter wire with the other rank soldiers. And they were, well, worse treated than we were, simply because of the very heavy demands put on them for work. And also because most of them, sadly, really didn't know and weren't used to living in the tropics.
Did sport play an important part in the life of the camp?
Physical sport, no. In fact, I cannot recollect playing any physical game at all the whole time I was there. I think for the most part people were too tired and exhausted. But there were also no facilities. I have no recollection of us ever having, for example, a football or anything of that sort. And I don't honestly think anyone would have wanted to play a game of football if we'd had one. So I think in terms of that sort of sport, the answer is no. In terms of indoor things, I think I've mentioned we played cards a lot. Other people played all sorts of funny games, lectures, talks, all that sort of thing.
What other funny games?
Well, games that were made up with counters, lots, or handmade dice, or anything you can think of. I mean, anything to keep people's minds alert in the evenings. Mm-hmm. Well, I won't say alert, but occupied. So, books, I think I have. Had I mentioned books? Or did you want to deal with that separately?
No.
Oh, because the Japanese did, after some while, it must have been after we'd been there about a year, they had ransacked the European houses, as far as I could see, up and down the whole coast, and came along and said that they would constitute a library of books. All other books which didn't have a rubber chop on them saying they were authorized by were to be banned. As a result of this, they did in fact produce quite a large number of books, including, at least 50 or so of my own, which I had come from my own house in Leuven. How they got there, I don't know. I still have two or three of them. We still have their chop on them. But they, and one or two law books, which were quite interesting, actually, because I could keep one's knowledge up to date or revised. But these books were quite a godsend. People took them out from the library and returned, and this was all controlled, of course, by ourselves. And this represented, I think, one of the most agreeable aspects of the camp life, really, the fact that we were able to, of course you had no choice in books, you took what it so happened other people had been reading or owned somewhere in the Bornean area, but it was useful. I think I should have mentioned that. And concerts and theatrical productions.
How were the books actually handed over to you and then organised into a library? Do you remember the arrival of these books?
Yes, I don't know that they all came at once. I think most of them did. But the Japanese then went through them with their own interpreter, or people whom they regarded as understanding English, to make sure that there was nothing derogatory to themselves. And then each book had a big Japanese rubber stamp put in it saying that it was authorized, at least I presume it said it because it was in Japanese, that it was authorized to be read by their prisoners. But no other book of any sort was permitted in the camp. Although I have a notion that two or three people had Bibles, which I think they did just wink at because they knew what they were. Especially as Sugar was himself a Methodist Christian.
Did you have any way of finding out what books they had decided was not suitable consumption for the internees?
Well, I hadn't, because I don't think in my house that there were any books that they would have resented, because there were no books that were particularly critical of Japanese policies or the Japanese past or anything of that sort. So I really can't say on what they ruled.
Been interesting
them out.
To have known what they weeded out, wouldn't it?
Yes, I think they devised this system more to give themselves an excuse to forbid books, in case we were somebody had got something they didn't like and was circulating it. And I mean, anything at all that was derogatory to Japan was completely taboo.
Who organized the library, and how was it done?
I really don't remember. We must have appointed, the committee must have appointed one or two individuals, I think, to look after it and to collect, to make sure that they were entered in and out and that people returned them and all that. But I'm afraid I don't remember the detail of it.
Right. Now, you said that there were quite a lot of classes and lectures that were put on by the internees themselves. I imagine the arrival of books must have aided this process somewhat.
Yes. In our camp, we were lucky from that point of view that we, it sounds rather arrogant, but we were on the whole a fairly well-educated crowd. Most people had expertise of some sort or another, which was interesting to somebody else. I mean, either of an academic nature or of work, his own work, his civil work, and the sort of things that he knew through his civil employment. And so we did have quite a lot of really very interesting talks. For example, there was a man called Digby who was the Italian, and who was an open communist. Well, he gave a series of talks on dialectical materialism, Marxism, Leninism and all this, and knew his stuff backwards. And mind you, in those days, communism was not so disreputable because Russia were our allies. I myself gave some talks on relativity, which I'd taken as a special subject in my degree, and which I could then remember. I can't remember anything about it now, of course. We had Noel Turner, I remember, who'd got a good history first at Oxford. He had a first-class memory and gave a series of talks on medieval and Elizabethan England. Well, all that sort of thing was going on. There was a Chinese consul in Borneo, a man who'd been educated, amongst other things, at the Sorbonne in Paris. Well, he gave some very interesting talks on, you know, on Chinese history. And his number two or number three, a little man called Philip Yong, was giving a series of lessons on Chinese, which I joined in for quite a while.
Chinese language.
The Chinese language, yes. Mandarin, or Guoyu, as it's called. The Pan-China language, not any of the dialects, such as Cantonese, Hokkien or anything.
Any
so
others?
All this sort of thing went on, which helped to keep one's mind off just being anxieties and worries. Mm.
Now, all the classes you've mentioned so far are a bit esoteric. Was there anything more of a practical nature?
Oh, yes, one or two people had gave talks on things like fishing or, I remember Sharky Taylor gave talks on shark fishing, which he knew a lot about. Somebody else knew something quite a bit about, I think it was brewing and distilleries, and gave talks on this, you know. all that. There's practical things as well. I didn't want to give the impression they were all academic, mm-hmm. but there was a good mix.
Which were the most popular?
It's hard to say. I think they were all popular. I think most people, once you knew a fellow could talk reasonably well and put his subject over, you didn't really mind what he was talking about. It was a way of entertaining yourself for an hour and a half in an evening.
Physically, how and where would these classes be organised?
In one of the huts in the evening. A notice would be shoved up on the board. If I remember rightly saying that Mr. So-and-so was going to give a talk on so-and-so at the time and the place, and anyone who wanted to turned up. Quite often, there'd be the best part of half the camp there if they could get in, if it was a very, something everyone was interested in.
Did the Japanese show any interest in these activities?
No, I don't think so. They were always a bit alarmed if there was too big a concentration of people in any one place, but once they realised that it was a perfectly bona fide thing, I don't think that we ever had any trouble with it. Not that I remember.
Mm. Now, you also said that you organised concert parties and things like that. Mm. Where did the inspiration for these activities come from?
Well, the lead was taken on theatrical productions, which included what I might call musicals, very largely by a man called Bishop, who was in the Public Works Department under the Chartered Company of North Borneo, but in some other earlier stage of his life had been in theatrical production. And he was really quite skilled at it, He knew how to produce a play, he knew how to direct amateur actors and prepare backdrops and all this sort of thing. Of course, we had no instruments. So it was just percussion, all that sort of nonsense.
So what did you do?
Well, some of the shows were just concocted as variety shows, really, I suppose you'd call them. One or two attempts were made at straight plays, which people had written. They weren't very good. But it was anything, really, to keep people's minds, or give people something reasonable to do in the evenings. You see, it got dark at 7 o'clock, half past 6 to 7. The gap from 7 till, I think it was 10 o'clock, was the final sort of lights out. There couldn't be any light in the camp after 10. Well, there was 3 hours to fill in then. Most people were pretty tired and exhausted. The light was often very inadequate. There were 3 or 4 miserable low-wattage bulbs in each hut. There wasn't very much you could do except read if you could get close enough to a light, or talk, or play bridge, or these sorts of things like laying on theatrical productions or listening to lectures, all that, you see.
In the concoctions, as you described them, did any particularly memorable talent get thrown up?
No, I don't think so. I don't recollect any, quite honestly. I don't think we really had any natural actors or, for that matter, natural singers.
Mm. Do you get involved in these sort of activities yourself?
I wrote one or two items, so to speak, which were shadow. I never myself performed.
So sketches, that kind of
thing?
Yeah. The straight plays, were there any recurrent themes or significant themes?
No, there weren't all that number, probably at the most there were 4 or 5 the whole time we were there, but an awful lot of work and effort went into preparing and producing them, and this is what really was the value of them, because they gave people something to do, and anything that kept your mind off yourself or your family or the immediate future.
How did they create so much work and involvement?
Well, people had to learn parts. People all had to rehearse. The producer had to arrange for backdrops to be prepared, bits of scenery, stage sets. All there was a lot of well, there is a lot of work, I think, in most theatrical productions, even such half-baked ones as we had. And half the, well, a large part of the morale, I think, of people depended on having something to occupy their minds in the evenings. In the daytime, it was less important because, well, there's an awful lot to do. The camp chores had to be done, the work had to be done. There were things going on. But once it was dark, that last 3 hours were the times when people's spirits could go very low.
Yes. Back props and drops and stage props, generally, their fabrication must have created some problems.
Oh, indeed, yes. I mean, everything created problems because we had nothing to do anything with, so to speak. It all had to be invented, conjured up in one way or another. But this, again, was a good thing in a sense that it meant people had to exercise their imagination and all that sort of thing.
Do you recall any specific examples of ingenuity to deal with the shortcomings?
I can't honestly say I do. No, they...
I'm interested in the relative affluence of people in the camp. Were there any significant differences of wealth amongst the internees?
Yes, some people had brought in, or were able to bring in by various ways, a certain amount of money. The Dutch, again, were rather on their own in this respect. They had quite a lot of Dutch guilders, or some of them had. We arranged fairly early on that all money should be pooled. But this was partly because the Japanese were insisting that all pre-war currency or pre-their occupation currency should be handed in exchange dollar for dollar for their military currency, which of course was, as the war went on, was becoming more and more worthless. In fact, it became, people were changing it on what you might call a black market at something like 1,000 to 1 before the end. I mean, because everyone realized that the Jap currency would be immediately demonetized as soon as the Allies arrived. But there were quite big differences. There were also very big differences in the, which was more important, in the possessions that people were able to bring in. I mean, some people were able to come in with suitcases full of all sorts of things. I mean, stocks of 50 or 100 razor blades, for example. Others had been captured in circumstances where they had next to nothing.
Did this imbalance in wealth bring out the best in people or the worst?
Difficult to say again. I think some people thought, well, I won't say they resented the wealth of others, but on the whole, most people who had anything really important, especially in anything in the nature of medicines or drugs, handed it over or were prepared to share it out when it was really necessary. I mean, I think my recollection is that all medicines of any sort were handed over to one or other of the 3 or 4 doctors in our camp and put under their administration. Now, it may well be that 1 or 2 people secreted stuff, you know, and never handed it over. There were always silly rumours of that sort going around, but I don't really know of any particular cases.
As far as money was concerned, for those who were reasonably well stocked with it, what use could they make of it?
Only unofficially, through a contact in the soldiers' camp, or at very grave risk, a contact of their own if they had one, went out on a working party. I think there were a handful. I never had one, and I never, in fact, knew of anybody that did. It wasn't a thing anyone dared to speak about, because a contact with anybody outside the camp was a very severe offence against Japanese regulations and led to a very dire punishment. So I think on the whole that people used their money either to buy articles off other internees, and where a fellow had money but no articles, as you might say, such as soap or razor blades or what have you, the fellow who had the soap and razor blades may have no money. It was still used to some extent as in what money is, as a medium of exchange. But there was an awful lot of direct bartering going on as well, of course, article for article.
Some people have a flair for commerce, for business, and manage to make money under almost any circumstances. I wonder if in Kuching, in the civilian internment camp, any such entrepreneurial talent demonstrated itself.
No, I didn't. I think what was noticeable, and I think I really mentioned this before, is that the Dutch were much more individualistic in this way. We ran the British element of the camp much more on communal lines. I won't say communist, but communal lines, and endeavoured to make even things out as best one could. But of course there were exceptions, and there were some people who objected on principle to handing in money and that sort of thing to receive in return for it worthless Japanese paper, or paper which we knew would be worthless.
That's what I... human nature being what it is, yeah. that's what I would expect.
Yes.
I'm surprised that things seem to have been done with so much equanimity as you've suggested.
Well, there wasn't all... I wouldn't say too much equanimity. I mean, there's no doubt people got money, but I don't know of anybody who had more than, shall we say, a couple of $100 or something, which really is very small beer. There was nobody there who, as far as I know, who'd come into the camp with thousands of dollars.
What about riches of possession? Was that accepted philosophically by those who lacked them, or did that cause any resentment?
I think on the whole it was accepted fairly philosophically. And as time went on, you see, things tended to get sorted out a bit. The fellow who had, for example, a lot of razor blades, I mean, everybody had run out of razor blades, of course, after about a couple of years, but nevertheless, people did try to shave a bit in the earlier days. He would find, for example, that he wanted tobacco, which he'd run out of. Well, he would swap one of his razor blades for tobacco that somebody else had got by some devious channel. Although tobacco was available from the Japanese on purchase with the money which we earned by working, the 15 cents a day.
Now tell me how that system worked.
Well, the Japanese...
You were paid a certain amount of money. Then what happened?
Well, you weren't paid it individually. A working party of so many people went out, worked for a day, and by an accounting exercise, that was multiplied by whatever the daily rate was, 15 cents or something, which meant there was a lump of so many dollars of money. Well, then the camp committee had a group of people who purchased requirements with that money. And in this, the Japanese merely said that this or that was or was not available. We had no control whatever of the price that they charged for it. But by and large, the sort of things that they tried to buy were soap, occasional supplementary food like eggs or something if they could be made available for people who were sick. I don't think they ever succeeded in buying any drugs or medicines. I don't think so. Toothbrushes. No, I don't think they ever got any of those either, because I remember people were using sticks to clean their teeth for about the last year or two. It's hard to remember what things they did buy now, but I think it was mostly small supplements to the diet, food, increases in food of one sort or another, and generally at a highly rigged artificial price.
Was there any sale of services as opposed to goods on the camp?
Well, there were individuals who had certain skills. I mean, one fellow might be quite a good carpenter, or he might be quite good at fixing broken plates or mugs, because most people broke their things at some stage or another. Well, insofar as that man could do it better than anybody else, he could also, incidentally, hair cutting was another one. Well, this was arranged. Generally, my recollection is you reimbursed him by either giving him something or, in terms of an article that you happen to have, or something quite trivial, or giving him a return service, something that you could do for him. That sort of thing went on quite a bit.
Can you give me any examples of that which involved you personally?
I can only remember haircuts. I did break...
You did the haircutting?
No, my hair was cut by somebody else.
And in return, what did you do?
I really can't remember what I did, but I must have done something, I think, to make it worth his while. I mean, not that he... Or it may have been that it was just a friendly arrangement, you know. I think on the whole, people... There was not a lot of selfish trading. There was some. And the most serious and stupid trading was the swapping of tobacco for food. There's no doubt about that. I mean, that went on quite a bit.
Stupid in what way?
Well, stupid from the point of view of the fellow that wanted the tobacco. I mean, it's astonishing how addictive a habit smoking is. I mean, even in conditions where people were starving, literally starving, there were still some people who would prefer tobacco, and who were prepared to swap a certain amount of their food, of their ration, so to speak, for a bit of so-called tobacco. This, I think, frowned on by most people, because a man was really killing himself doing it. But still, it's a free country. It wasn't a free camp, but a man can do what he wants.